We're picking up where we left off a long time ago. And I think last time I said this that would be the last class on the intertestamental period, but maybe this semester will be the last section on the intertestamental period. We'll get up through into the New Testament era, and then that'll be the end of that. As Pastor said, it seems to have expanded well beyond the original 12 weeks that I thought it was going to take. So this is actually the third semester that we'll be doing this topic. So I thought what we'd do today, and I think most of you have been in the class before. If you haven't, we'll do a little bit of review today to kind of get everybody back in the intertestamental mindset. It took me a long time. It's been a while since we did this, over a year, I think, since we were studying this period before. So I had forgotten a lot of the stuff that we had gone over. And if I had forgotten it, I'm sure all of you have forgotten it as well. So I thought we would do a very brief review of everything that we've covered just to get us back thinking about the context and everything. And then we'll pick up where we left off and finish it into the New Testament era. So with that said, I'll just dive right in here. And I've provided you an outline. So the first handout is an outline. It's front and back. Just an outline of basically the review that we'll do. And then there's another sheet with a couple figures on it that we can use to reference in a few minutes. So just to bring us all back focused on the intertestamental period, what is the intertestamental period? It's the 400 silent years between the Old and the New Testaments. Why is it called the silent years? Jen? That's right. There was no revelation happening during that period of time that we have, you know, it's between the end of the Old Testament and the beginning of the New Testament. And if you remember, we looked at how the very ending of the Old Testament ties in very nicely with the beginning of the New Testament, how it's sort of a cliffhanger ending at the end of the Old Testament in Malachi. And then chronologically, the first words that we read in the New Testament are in the Gospel of Luke. And it picks up directly. There's a direct connection between the final words in Malachi and the opening words where John the Baptist comes on the scene in the book of Luke. So why study this period? Well, I think we all have a gap in knowledge in this period of time. For me, it was always a mystery. I never really knew what had happened during that period of time between the Testaments. I vaguely knew that there were a lot of things that had happened with literature and the rising of the Jewish sects and things like that that we find in the New Testament. But it was all kind of mysterious, and so I think it's probably safe to say that most of us had a gap in knowledge of the intertestamental period. And then important literary developments there under B1. There were a lot of important literary developments during this period. One of them was the Greek translation of the Old Testament that happened in Alexandria. So we talked about that. That's called the Septuagint, which is a very important translation for the New Testament writers. That's most likely the version of the Old Testament that the New Testament writers knew and had access to. And you'll see some quotations in the New Testament that you read. You go back and look at the Old Testament quotation, and it doesn't seem to be the same thing. And then you'll see a little text note that says, from the Septuagint. So that's from the Greek translation of the Old Testament. So a lot of the New Testament writers were drawing on that as their Old Testament source in Greek. Judaism, a lot of important documents that shed light on what was going on with the Jewish religion during this time. A good example of that is the Dead Sea Scrolls that have been found recently in 1947. A lot of those documents are from this period of time, and so that was sort of a treasure and a gold mine of archaeological significance to understand what was happening during this period of time. And then the Apocrypha. A lot of the Apocryphal books were written during this time, and those have a lot of significance both from a historical standpoint in telling us history during the intertestamental period, but also a significant influence on Roman Catholic and Eastern Orthodox theology, as that is part of their Bible to varying degrees. We went over that before, so I won't cover all that again, but another important literary development during the time. And then, of course, under B2 there, the intertestamental period provides context for the New Testament. So that's ultimately what our goal is to better understand the New Testament context. And this is actually part of what we're going to be doing this semester, is looking at the political, religious, and cultural significance of the intertestamental period on the New Testament. So, for example, we went into this in great detail in the class before, but for example, when we open the pages of the New Testament, we find things that we're all very familiar with now because we know our Bibles, things such as the Herods, King Herod, and the other Herods. Roman rule is another good example. Synagogues are very prevalent in the New Testament, and then things like the Pharisees and the Sadducees. None of those things are in the Old Testament. So the Old Testament ends, the New Testament opens, and all of those things are seemingly taken for granted when you open the New Testament. There's no explanation of what a synagogue is or where it came from, for instance. So by studying the intertestamental period, we can see the rise of all of those institutions and groups of people and individuals. And so I think having a good understanding of this period helps us to read our New Testaments more accurately and in context. So that's another important reason to study the period. Okay, and then under 1C there, the outline of the course. By the way, stop me, raise your hand if you want to ask a question or make a comment. I'm just kind of blowing through this pretty quickly. So we've covered 1 through 6 for the most part, and we're going to pick up at the end of number 6, which is the literature of the period. We almost made it through that, but not quite. So we'll pick up there, and then we'll look at a couple noteworthy developments during the period, and then get into the New Testament context, or the context for the New Testament, if you will. And so I skipped over 1 through 6 because I'm going to give a little explosion of each of those here in the review. So the first one there is the Old Testament background. So in the Old Testament background, we actually went back to the end of the Old Testament and saw what's happened there leads into the intertestamental period. So we looked at the return from exile, which happened under the Persian Empire, the rebuilding of the temple and the rebuilding of the walls of Jerusalem. We looked at the events in Esther, which again, all of these are happening under the Persian Empire. And then final events in the Old Testament. So we looked at Ezra, Nehemiah, and Malachi. So for instance, Ezra's journey to Jerusalem, then subsequently Nehemiah's journey to Jerusalem, which we read about in the book of Nehemiah. And then at the end of Nehemiah, we read about how Nehemiah went back to Persia and then came back again to Jerusalem. And that was pretty much at the end of the Old Testament chronology there. The ending note of the Old Testament. So one of the things we looked at was, what kind of a feeling do you get when you finish the Old Testament? When you read the last chronological books, Ezra, Nehemiah, Malachi, what kind of a feeling do you get? What's the end note of the Old Testament? And the end note is really continued disobedience is what we find. And so if you remember, what did Nehemiah find when he came back again? He seemingly set everything straight when he came to Jerusalem. You remember all of the things that he did, as well as Ezra with the intermarriage problems that they were addressing. And Nehemiah did all kinds of things to rebuke the leaders and, of course, rebuild the walls of Jerusalem and all that type of thing. But then what did he find, you know, 20 years later or less when he returned? It was a mess again. I don't know if you remember that, but it was just a complete mess again. And so that's what we find at the end of Nehemiah. And then Malachi, the final words of Malachi, are really a rebuke and an expectation of judgment, of coming judgment, which is very interesting because of the way that the New Testament opens with John the Baptist preaching for everyone to repent. So the ending note of the Old Testament was really one of continued disobedience leading into the intertestamental period. Okay, so that was the Old Testament background. Drawing a line there. Yes, Bill. Yeah, the question was, is there a tension between the way the Old Testament ends and the New Testament and sort of a building up? And then the New Testament opens with the Word of God coming again. And I think that's definitely in play, yes. I thought you were going to ask for a prophetic revelation this morning where you were going with that. But and what you said with John the Baptist reminds me of the opening words of Elijah. And I'm drawing a blank who wrote that now. Pastor, maybe you know the oratorio Elijah.
No,
Mendelssohn. The way that opens very powerfully is, thus saith the Lord. You hear this man's voice, thus saith the Lord, the God of hosts. It reminds me of that. Boom. If you listen to that, you'll understand what I'm talking about. So, yeah, that's a good point. There's definitely that. It's sort of a cliffhanger ending, really. It doesn't read like a cliffhanger, but when you put the two together, you can definitely see how it picks up again right where it left off with a 400-year gap with that sense of power. The Word of God is coming again. Yes, Daniel. Right, yeah. So another theme would be maybe continued disobedience leads to what the Bible calls a famine of the word, right? There's no word at that period of time. It could be for the continued disobedience. I mean, ultimately, we know that it's all part of God's plan to bring the Savior in the fullness of time. And that's what ultimately is going on behind the scenes on the higher register, if you will. Good discussion, and hopefully your minds are getting back to what we are covering. So we'll go now to the sources. So how do we know about the intertestamental period? We don't have a lot of biblical revelation for this period, biblical history, so how do we know about it? Well, the book of Daniel gives us a lot of information more from a prophetic standpoint. So in chapters 2, 7, and 8, you remember the visions that we covered of the world empires, which were very accurate predictions of what was happening in the world empire scene. And then chapter 11 goes beyond that into the Diadochen period, which we'll review here in a minute. But you remember all of the bizarre political intrigue that happens in Daniel chapter 11. We sort of traced through that and saw how it related to the events that actually unfolded during the intertestamental period. Then other non-biblical sources, we've got the Apocrypha, of course, which we mentioned before. Two important books there are 1st and 2nd Maccabees, which are reliable historical records for the most part of the Maccabean period and the revolt. And then we have this body of literature called the Pseudepigrapha, which is another group of books similar to the Apocrypha that are written under pseudonyms. That's where that fancy name comes from, but it's pseudonyms of famous people. But there's a lot of interesting material in there, too, that we talked about. The Letter of Aristeas, which is actually considered part of the Pseudepigrapha, that's the book or the letter that gives us the legendary account of how the Septuagint was translated in Egypt. So that's where that comes from. And then the Dead Sea Scrolls, I mentioned that before. We're actually going to pick up when we get through the review. Where we left off was at the Dead Sea Scrolls. So I won't talk a lot about that because we're going to pick up on that here in a little bit. Josephus, probably the most important non-biblical historical source is Josephus. You can see from his dates there on the outline, he lived through a lot of the later Jewish revolt period, and he lived in the Roman Empire. And he wrote four major works, and the two that we're using most extensively are his Wars of the Jews and his book called Antiquities of the Jews. So both of those are major historical sources that we're drawing on heavily here, and other people that I'm using as sources are drawing on Josephus as their primary source. And then there's actually a lot of other historians that we didn't really talk much about. Maybe some of the ones you've heard of are Philo, Herodotus, and Xenophon are some of the more important ones. Then there's a few others. And some of the Roman writers have written history of this period. And so we're drawing on them a little bit, but mainly just through secondary sources. I haven't done much reading in those primary sources. Yes, Daniel. Yeah, Ezekiel, right, wrote from Babylon. He tells us a little bit about the Babylonian conditions, right, but not in a prophetic sense like Daniel, where he's giving us very specific things that have now happened already in history that we can look back on and go, oh, yeah, that's a direct fulfillment of that prophecy. And then I've got a lot of secondary sources that I've used for this study, and I've got the bibliography available if anybody wants it. I can provide that to you. Some of the good books that I've used are in our church library. And I know some of you have bought a couple of the very interesting history books that I recommended earlier. You'll see as we go through which ones we're using primarily. Okay, so that's how we know about the intertestamental period. Any questions about that? Okay. So that'll bring us into the historical summary. So now here we're going from the beginning of the intertestamental period up to the Maccabean period, which is the revolt that happened. And so here we covered the book of Daniel. This is where we went through the book of Daniel in some detail. And you remember what is going on in the book of Daniel from a historical standpoint. God revealed the general outline of what was going to happen in the future to Daniel through a series of visions. And that included the Persian Empire, the Greek Empire, the Roman Empire, as well in chapter 11 of a lot of the Hellenistic events and Hellenistic battles that happened in the later intertestamental period. So we looked at all that. We had a couple tables that we used that show how the visions all line up and what they represent. You can find those in most of your study Bibles have those also. I think the NIV study Bible has one and then has a nice graphic. And then the ESV study Bible, I think, has a nice table lining all those things up. So you can find that in your Bibles. And then the Persian dynasty was one thing that we spent a lot of time on. And here you might want to refer to figure 1 on your other sheet. This is just a quick table that I generated that shows the year in that kind of center column with any kind of biblical reference that we find. And then down the left-hand side, it lines those events up with the Persian ruler at the time. And so we'll kind of walk down through these Persian rulers real quickly here. So we looked at these rulers both from what we know about them from the Bible, and that's where the biblical references come in there, but also from secular histories, we know a lot about some of these rulers. By the way, the years here are, I think I had that on your outline. Yeah, 550 to 332 BC, that's what those numbers are supposed to be there. And then I've listed the rulers there in your outline, and they line up hopefully with what you find on this table. We looked first at Cyrus, who of course is a major biblical figure. He's the one that decreed that the Jews should return from the exile back to Jerusalem. We looked at the Cyrus cylinder. We actually watched a little video about the Cyrus cylinder since that was touring around at the time. I think actually, Tom, you saw it, right, in Washington when it was in D.C.? Yeah. So that was a major archaeological find that was touring around our country a few years ago. We also sorted out some of the various biblical identity questions, like how does Belshazzar relate? Also, who is Darius the Mede? How does that relate to Cyrus? We kind of sorted all those things out. By the way, so I'm going over this very quickly. If you wanted to go over any of this again, any of those questions, I believe all the lectures are online and all the handouts are available too. If you want to go back and just brush up on anything in detail. The next ruler after Cyrus was Cambyses. He's not mentioned in the Bible and had a relatively short reign of 8 years. And after that, we have Darius the Great, who was another major Persian ruler that we know from the Bible. He's the one that would have been during the time of Haggai and Zechariah when they were rebuilding or renewing the building of the temple. We looked at one other important historical find there, archaeological find. He's the one that commissioned the Behistun inscription. And if you remember what that is, it's a huge linguistic message that's written in three different languages on the side of a mountain in modern-day Iran. And it was written in Old Persian, Babylonian, and Elamite, and it was an important linguistic tool to be able to understand the Babylonian language. So it's similar to the more famous Rosetta Stone that helped us with the Egyptian hieroglyphics. This helped us with the Babylonian language. And you can, if you just go online, you can find pictures of that. It's a very impressive sight carved in the face of this rock way up on this mountain. And it was basically a propaganda tool for all of the caravans that would go by there. They would read something about Darius. But because it's written in three different languages, it's of great use to us today. So you can see pictures of that if you look on the web. So that was Darius. And then we come to Xerxes, who was after that also in Hebrew, or in the Old Testament, he's referred to as Ahasuerus. This is the king that was in power during the time of Esther. So he's the king in the book of Esther. And something that's not recorded in the Bible, but he led a major campaign against Greece. He pushed all the way to the borders of Greece and almost conquered Greece. That's an important historical event because that was part of the catalyst for the Greek Empire later wanting to go and overrun the Persian Empire. So that was an important military thing that was going on during that time. And then following him, we have Artaxerxes the first, because there's other Artaxerxes after him. But this is the king that Nehemiah would have been the cupbearer to. So he's the king that said, "Why do you have a frowning face?" And then he allowed him to go back and actually more than allowed him, gave him a lot of authority to be the governor of Judea at the time. So he's the king that would have authorized Ezra and Nehemiah to go back. And during his rule in Persia, the beginnings of the Greek Empire were stirring in the West. And so that was starting to happen there during that period of time that we read about in the Bible, actually. So then there's five later rulers leading up to the rise of the Greek Empire. And so just in summary for the Persian Empire, the Persian dynasty was a unified and powerful, widespread, and long-lived power. It's really one of the great empires of the world that the world has ever seen. It was generally, and something I didn't mention here at all in the review, but the Persian rule was generally very friendly to the Jews. And we can tell that from the Bible when we read about all the good things that happened to the Jews under the Persian Empire. It provided for their return from exile back to Jerusalem, supported the rebuilding of the temple and Jerusalem. It also placed Jews in important political positions, and one example of that is in Esther. Mordecai was the second highest ruler in the Persian Empire, believe it or not, and he was a Jew that was in exile. So they put Jews in important positions like that. Another good example of that is there were garrisons of the Persian army stationed in Egypt, and they enlisted Jews as loyal soldiers in their regiments in Egypt, and even some in positions of some authority there. So that just shows you that there was generally a good relationship between the Jews and the Persian politically at that time. And then finally, last thing to say about the Persian Empire is Persia left its mark in Palestine, both in the way that Jewish architecture used Persian ideas, as well as the Aramaic language. So the Aramaic language, of course, is a very important language at the time. It's probably the language that Jesus spoke most often, and it's actually a Persian dialect of Assyrian. So they left that language heritage in the Palestinian area of the time. So that brings us to the end of the Persian period, and then we looked at the Alexandrian period. Oh, we have a question somewhere. Yes, Daniel. It's in modern-day Iran, right. Well, yeah, Islam. All this is pre-Islam, remember. So, yeah, that's a major ideological change that has happened in that area. It's really, right in that area. So that's probably, I would think, the most telling difference. Yeah. Remember that a lot of these world empires, they had their own cultures, but they weren't as different as things are different today, I think, between the East and the West. I mean, there's still a big difference between the East and the West even back then, but there's probably a lot of commonality in habits and customs and things like that between the Persians and the Jews at that time. So not as big of a difference that way. There was a big religious difference, meaning monotheism and the one true God and, the idolatry of the nations, but not the hostility that we would see today, for instance. Okay, so then coming to the Alexandrian period, of course, here we have Alexander the Great, who was a brilliant military strategist, very charismatic leader, and who pretty much conquered almost all of the known world in like 20 years, so very remarkable accomplishment. But he started in Greece, came through Asia Minor, into Palestine, down into northern Egypt, and then pushed his way through Persia, conquered the Persian Empire, and made his way actually all the way to the borders of what is India today, before his armies mutinied and made him turn back. And then you probably know the story with him, but he died very shortly thereafter of a fever, very quickly and unexpectedly at a young age. But in the short period of time, he spread Greek culture everywhere. And nations were very attracted to the Greek culture. They saw it as a superior way of life. The Greeks saw it that way, but actually a lot of other Eastern people accepted that and embraced that sort of idealistic view of Greek culture. And so Alexander is really one of the remarkable people in history because he really changed the course of history completely in a single decade. If you can imagine that today, it's kind of hard to fathom how that could happen like that. The spreading of Greek culture, we use the term Hellenism to refer to that. Hella is the Greek word for Greece. If you look at their coins or stamps, you can see that on there. And Hellenism is the spreading then of the Greek culture throughout the world. And we'll be referring to that term, Hellenism, a lot because it influenced the Jews in Palestine significantly. And his Hellenism really long outlived him. in the way that he brought Greek culture and language and customs to the near and far eastern nations. And the Jews, of course, were not immune to this, and they were being increasingly influenced by this cultural change and the religious temptation that came with it over the coming centuries. And that really played itself out in the next period here, which is the period under the Ptolemies and the Seleucids. We've got about 5 more minutes, so I'm going to keep pushing on, but if you have any questions, just, again, raise your hand. So here's some other bizarre terms, Ptolemies and Seleucids. What does that mean? Those are the names of the two prominent leaders who arose out of the split up of Alexander's empire after his death. So after Alexander died unexpectedly, his empire was eventually divided under various successors. And this is sometimes called the Diadochen period. Diadochen comes from a Greek term meaning successor. So it just means that the successors of Alexander the Great. After Alexander died, you remember there was a lot of political intrigue back and forth, basically power struggles among the various successors to see who was going to win out. There were 5 main successors. Most of them had been generals under Alexander. There were 5 main people vying for power. In the book of Daniel, chapters 8 and 11 describe this period of conflict and chaos in prophetic form. And so if you've ever read those chapters, particularly Daniel 11, and been wondering what in the world is it talking about, it's this very convoluted and complex area of wars going on back and forth after the division of Alexander's empire. If you read that chapter with the ESV Study Bible, that's a good way to work your way through it because the notes down below tell you everything that's happening. Yes, Pastor. Pastor has sermons on Daniel, those probably on the website also, or they're available to listen to. And there's lots of confusion there at the end of the book of Daniel. It all makes sense when you work through it, but to the casual reader, it can be quite daunting. Okay, and so basically, all that set up 2 successive periods of domination. The first was by the Ptolemies, and the second by the Seleucids. Ptolemies is just taken from the name of the major leader, one of Alexander's generals named Ptolemy. And then the second, the Seleucids, that was another leader, Seleucus. So they were in 2 different areas geographically. The Ptolemies settled sort of in Egypt, the northern Egypt area, and then the Seleucids would be more in modern-day Syria or Assyria. So those are the 2 sort of major fallouts that ended up butting heads. And where did they butt heads geographically? Right in Palestine. That's the meeting point. So that's why it concerns us to pay a little bit of attention here to see what was happening in Palestine during this period. So under D3 there, the Ptolemaic domination of Palestine happened roughly between 301 to 198 BC. And basically this was characterized by Hellenization of Upper Egypt with Alexandria as the center. So this is the time when Alexandria really became the center for Greek culture. And I mentioned before the Septuagint, the Old Testament was translated into Greek during this period of time in Alexandria. So Alexandria really became a very important city in the Greek Empire. And Alexandria really had a strong Jewish population as well. Alexandria was broken into 5 major sections, and there's estimates that at least 1 or 1.5 of the major sections of Alexandria were Jewish. So that gives you a sense of how many Jews were living in Alexandria at the time. Information about the state of the Jews during the Ptolemaic period is pretty sparse, but we do know that they were under a strong and well-organized government. Of course, the Ptolemaic leaders used Palestine for their own political purposes, but they generally allowed freedom for the Jews to live according to their traditions and their religion. So again, this is a pretty friendly period for the Jews under the Ptolemaic rulers. The Hellenization that began under Alexander the Great continued to grow during this period. Both the Ptolemies and Seleucids, even though we think of them as sort of Egyptian and Syrian, remember, they're all Greek at this point. So these are all Greek people. There's significant Hellenization going on. They're really trying to emulate Greek culture. So although it was really a war between 2 rival Greek leaders, the conflict between the Ptolemies and the Seleucids eventually, it basically just continued the age-old conflict that we find in the Bible between the superpowers of Assyria and Egypt. Remember how King Josiah was killed, or maybe that was the Babylonians. But remember, the Assyrians and the Egyptians were continually warring at the time. Yeah, that's right. So Josiah was most likely allied with the Babylonians at the time. And so he tried to intervene when the Pharaoh went up to fight against the king of Assyria, if you remember. And that's how he was killed. So we find those wars happening in the Bible. And now we've just got basically a Hellenized version of these same wars happening with Palestine as the battleground. So at some point then, around 198 BC, the balance of power shifted over to the northern folks, the Seleucids. So the Seleucids gained the upper hand, and they began to dominate Palestine at that time. And in the early going, the Seleucid rulers were very similar to the Ptolemies. They were very friendly towards the Jews. They had friendly policies. They allowed them to maintain their ancestral religious practices and all that type of thing. But then if you remember, through a series of rulers, we ended up with the notorious ruler, Antiochus IV Epiphanes, who's the one who, for whatever reason, that the reasons are hotly debated, decided to force Hellenism on the Jews and basically outlaw Judaism. And this was, of course, a really bad period in Jewish history. Epiphanes means manifestation of God, so that's the name that he gave himself. Antiochus took the name Epiphanes, meaning I'm a manifestation of God. To show you what his contemporaries thought of him, his detractors came up with another name for him, namely Epimenes, which means madman. So even his contemporaries recognized that he was, you know, kind of crazy. And then this is the king who's described in Daniel 8 and chapter 11. So if you get to those points and you start seeing references to the little horn, if you remember, and the king of bold face who lied and things like that, those are almost certainly references to this person, Antiochus IV. Anyways, this guy is the one that compelled Hellenization on the Jews, and I'll just read this. We're out of time. Let me just read this, and then we'll pick up here next week. This really led to what's called the period of Antiochian persecution, and there was a big power struggle here, which I'll skip for now, but it ended up with massacres, the desecration of the temple, the breakdown of the city walls, and the outlawing of Judaism. And there's all kinds of horrible stories about what happened during this period. If you read the book of, it's either 1st or 2nd Maccabees, or maybe both, have some of this, as well as Josephus. So what we want to take away from this period is it was an extremely tumultuous period in history. Imagine the Jews, they're under changing overlords all the time. The land was a continual battleground between these two rival superpowers. It was also a time of tremendous cultural change. The Hellenization was happening. There was a strong religious temptation to capitulate to those Hellenizing forces, which of course would be anti the God of the Bible, both from without and within. We'll talk a little bit about that next week. But basically, the Antiochian persecution, the desecration of the temple, the massacres that happened at this time, was really the straw that broke the camel's back in terms of leading to open rebellion and revolt. And this, for the pious community, ultimately led to the Maccabean revolt, which we'll cover next week.